You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the October 2019 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part B. Lara Regensdorf gives us this article on My Place, local time. For Valentino creative director Pier Paolo Piccioli, Rome's cultural contradictions make for ripe inspiration. Illustrations for this article are by Sarah Maycock. That tension between high and low, pagan and Catholic, that's the feeling that Roma wants to deliver, Pier Paolo Piccioli says, about his birthplace and that of Valentino, the nearly 60-year-old fashion house he has led since 2008. He assumed sole creative control in 2016. The city's roots in duality, wolf-weaned twins Romulus and Remus are its mythic founders, live on for the designer, whether he's taking the train from seaside Nettuno while watching Fellini films on a laptop, or putting forth Born in Roma, a his-and-hers scent fronted by models Anwar Hadid and Adut Akech. She wears couture like it's a T-shirt, Piccioli says of Akech's effortless elegance, which applies as handily to the man himself. When you work in Rome, you can't compete with Caravaggio or Bernini, so you do what you can. In the illustrations and photos, for me, the Italian maestros like Antonioni, Fellini, and Pasolini show how thoughts and beauty can be linked. And shown here is an Antonioni movie poster. A resort 2020 look. In the Orto Botanico, the garden is a treasure because it's in the heart of the city, but it's like being out of the world. And a bottle of Valentino perfume. The bottle represents the feeling of couture, but at the same time, a punk attitude. I loved the recent exhibition at Maxi of Paolo Di Paolo, so intimate and personal, Anna Magnani. Photographed by Di Paolo, 1955. In Roma, you never have the sense of the past as a source of nostalgia. Arapacis, a Roman altar from 9 BC, in a glass and steel building by Richard Meyer. One of my favorite religious spaces in San Luigi dei Francesi, because of the Caravaggio's there. He painted saints as people, which was outrageous for his time. The Inspiration of St. Matthew, 1602. Thank you. From Keziah Wire comes this article on style, bel canto. Break out the cough drops and flick open the lorgnette. The opera is getting a refresh. Photograph by Horacio Salinas. And it shows a lantern bag. The 19th century boom of classics, from Verdi's Otello to Puccini's La Bohème, may be known as the art form's golden age, but operas are having a modern moment. Hot off a summer that debuted Fire, Shut Up in My Bones, Opera Theater of St. Louis, adapted from Charles Blow's memoir about growing up in segregated Louisiana, and the queer epic Stonewall, New York City Opera. The upcoming season includes world premieres of Deni and Katya, based on the social media-centric story of two Russian teen runaways, Opera Philadelphia, and The Lost Thing, featuring a cast with varying physical abilities, London's Royal Opera. Of course, the classics still wield political relevance. The Marriage of Figaro is an opera buffa about overthrowing the upper classes. Verdi inspired rebellion. Beethoven's Fidelio celebrates human rights. So make like it's 1877. Phone off, curtain up. Skin Deep by Lara Regensdorf. In the booming beauty game, the quest for the dream cream is driving creativity in and out of the jar. In the photo, Gray Sorrenti, captured by her father, Mario Sorrenti, the fashion photographers have partnered with Le Maire on a new campaign. And Ace of Face, Macrane Active's high-performance face cream, Le Maire Crème de Le Maire by Sorrenti, Augustinus Bader, the rich cream, and Olay Retinol 24-night moisturizer, pictured here. Makeup is for the mercurial, the quick-change artist who swap their neon liner with every shift in weather or mood. But skincare stirs fidelity at a time when optimized health is the greatest luxury. A radiant visage is the clearest indicator. Multi-step routines and individual needs suggest there's no single fix, but whispers still swirl among Reddit beauty diehards about this fabled cream or that. Indiana Jones had an easier time finding the Holy Grail. Even with a glut of competition, Le Maire, that 1990s cause for devotion and sticker shock, still has its tribe. Now a new collaboration foretells next-gen fandom. Photographers Mario Sorrenti and his 18-year-old daughter, Gray, a rising phenom in the family trade, have created a salt-sprayed campaign for the cultish Crème de la Mer. In Spain and St. Bart, the two took turns on both sides of the lens, resulting in black-and-white shots, 16-millimeter footage, and custom jars. "I grew up in the ocean," Gray says of their holidays, confessing that she also grew up dipping into her mother's La Mer as a little girl. It soothed her problematic skin. It wasn't hype, but word-of-mouth praise at Zitome, the iconic Upper East Side pharmacy that turned them on to it decades ago, recalls Mario. "The most important thing is that the product works," he says. If a so-called miracle broth of potent fermented kelp is La Mer's secret sauce, the proprietary stem cell technology TFC8 is what powers Augustinus Bader. The German face cream line that has much of Hollywood in thrall. For those who can't get enough, a body cream launched in July via the beauty site Violet Grey. "We joke around that we're drug dealers, and technically we kind of are," say the boutique's founder, Cassandra Heisenstreit Grey, of the science-backed skincare, which young people have been springing for like they used to invest in shoes. The cost, she concedes, is the only issue with recommending it all the time. Pairing efficacy with accessibility is what Olay aims to do with its Retinol 24 moisturizer, easy on the wallet and on skin. Retinoids, the class of vitamin A derivatives used to treat acne and signs of aging by revving up cell turnover, can cause irritation, but this blend of retinol and retinyl propionate is gentle enough for daily use. "While a prescription retinoid offers the most bang," says dermatologist Heidi Waldorf, MD, "it doesn't have to be all or nothing. Switching between the strong stuff and over-the-counter options can be a good balance." For dermatologist Macrane Alexiadis, MD, PhD, hero ingredients come by the dozens. Her original skincare debut, a multi-action cream with a natural-leaning ethos, kicked off the label 37 Active. Sienna Miller has cast her vote. 10 years and 6 products later, she's set to unveil Macrane Active, a reformulation and a refresh to raise the bar even higher, she says, citing DNA repair enzymes and recyclable packaging. She's growing feverfew and mint in Rhinebeck, New York, for future use in the line. Olive extracts from her land in Greece are to follow. "It's a next-level doctor brand," she says. "Health, for the earth, for the human, for the skin. On to the Vanity Fair agenda, promotion, events. Event, Hive Salon presented Dell Technologies. This past July in New York City, Vanity Fair and Dell Technologies hosted a panel discussion on technology and sustainability in the workplace, moderated by Hive senior editor Claire Lansbaum. The panel featured female business leaders who have put sustainability at the forefront of their missions. Rent the Runway's Anushka Salinas, Lola's Jordana Keir, and Sidewalk Labs' Emily Kildow talked about the importance of balancing environmental aims with business realities. Afterward, guests joined reception where a selection of Dell's latest products were on display. Event, a day in the French countryside. Automotive competition Chantilly Arts and Elegance returned to the Domaine de Chantilly outside of Paris last summer and attracted more than 18,000 visitors. Presented by Swiss watch manufacturer Richard Mille, the event united 16 automotive brands and 710 of the world's most beautiful classic cars. During Sunday's Concours d'Elegance concept car competition, each entrant took to the runway paired with a fashion designer's creation. On music, rock, and royal, being gay gave me more respect than I saw given to a lot of straight women in similar situations, says King Princess about growing up around her father's Brooklyn recording studio. It eliminated that sexual nature in working with men, adds the 20-year-old singer, songwriter, producer. Her acclaimed indie EP on Mark Ronson's Zelig label led to this month's release of her debut studio album, Cheap Queen, and a current U.S. headlining tour. Here she discusses studios, sexuality, and sad songs with Lisa Robinson. You're a native New Yorker. Why are you living in Los Angeles? New York is tough. Growing up there and taking the subway, I feel like I got all my tough shit out. Now I'm living and enjoying the sun. What did you learn from being around your father's studio? 10 years ago, not a lot of women were producing themselves. They'd record a whole album, then come back with the edits from the label and re-record everything all over again. It was startling to watch music get mutilated. Is it true your great-great-grandfather, Isidore Strauss, was a U.S. congressman who was considered a hero when he died on the Titanic? Yes, my great-great-grandparents were wealthy Jewish philanthropists who owned Macy's, and they decided to take a luxury trip on the Titanic. They gave up their spots on the lifeboats to die together. So romantic. How hard is it to maintain a personal life while you're on tour? You used to date actress Amanda Stenberg. Are you seeing anyone now? I am dating someone now. The hardest part of juggling a relationship is allowing yourself to miss someone and to know that missing someone is healthy. But I've found that type of pain informs my work. I'm getting better at accepting the reality that my life, in many ways, is transient. Your real name is Michaela Strauss. How did you get to be King Princess? A friend of mine used to call me that, and it just felt right. I wasn't fully formed into my genderqueer self at the time and couldn't comprehend all the levels. But I am a King Princess. It's very in-between and fluid. What were your goals for this new album? I wrote about 30 to 40 songs between my EP and this new record. What I was going for was something more evolved. I wanted something a step up, production-wise. Do you ever just turn songwriting off? I go through months where I'll write so many songs, then get bored with myself and have nothing to say. So I'll do anything outside of music, like comedy. Part of me just wants to be funny, because my music is sad. I play songs for people. They tell me it makes them really sad, and I say, yeah, I was really sad when I wrote it. You used to be nervous to play live. Are you more comfortable now? I kind of am, because I'm usually stoned.
Thank you.
onto the fairground, hot to handle, from a roped-off rodeo drive to an after-party in an iconic home, Louis Vuitton created a luxe fantasy land for L.A.'s creative set by Brett Hennemuth, with photographs by Roger Kisby. Fashion fans lined Rodeo Drive to catch a glimpse of Millie Bobby Brown, Hailee Steinfeld, Miranda Kerr, and others arriving at Louis Vuitton X, an exhibition that spans 160 years of the French luxury house's archives. After taking in the exhibit, guests headed to the John Lautner-designed Sheets Goldstein House, perched above Beverly Hills, for caviar and champagne. Jaden Smith boogied to the sounds of Saudi-born society DJ sisters Simi and Hayes, while Orlando Bloom mingled with Frank Gehry and Larry Gagosian. Six contemporary artists, Jonas Wood, Sam Falls, Urs Fischer, Nicholas Lobo, Chabalala Self, and Alex Israel, used the Capucine bag as a canvas to reimagine a new collection of the signature purses. In the photos, inside the Louis Vuitton X exhibition in Beverly Hills, Lara Harrier and Alicia Vikander, Jennifer Connelly, Orlando Bloom and Frank Gehry, an Arte Capucine bag by Alex Israel. One of the decorative surfboard fins has a comb attached, the other a mirror. Millie Bobby Brown and Delphine Arnault, who hosted the evening with Michael Burke. Guests explore the immersive exhibition, the Dolan twins, Ethan and Grayson. Now here's this month's cover story, Upon a Star, by Kimberly Drew. The Black Panther and Us actor has spun a dynamic career on her own terms and in rapid fashion. Good thing the sky's the limit. With photographs by Jackie Nickerson, styled by Samira Nasser. In the photos, full bloom, Lupita Nyong'o in the gardens of the Pleasant Dale Chateau in West Orange, New Jersey. Lupita Nyong'o glides into the restaurant at our appointed time, the picture of cool, in a blue charmeuse jumpsuit with a camel-colored rain jacket draped over her arm. If diners are aware a star is among us, they don't betray it. After briefly casting about for a different table, then deciding the one we've got will do, she jumps directly, wholeheartedly, into the interview, clothes first. The gesture of my style is definitely my mom. I always thought she was very elegant, and she was always present with the way she put herself together, without being pressured, says Nyong'o, citing her mother's ritual home manicure every Sunday night while the family watched television together. But she also looked up to her Aunt Amandi, her mother's sister, whose style tacked in the opposite direction, black leather jackets, a mohawk at one point, even the motorcycle to complete the look. I kind of oscillated between the two. I find I love the elegant, the classic, the simple, but I also like the outrageous and the quirky and the almost accidental. Nyong'o could almost be describing her career, except for the accidental part. The year started with a premiere of Little Monsters, a comedic Australian-American-British zombie flick, went right into the smash success of Jordan Peele's horror drama, Us, in which she plays heroine Adelaide Wilson and her demonic doppelganger, Red, and will close out after she reprises her role as CGI alien Maz Kanata in Star Wars, The Rise of Skywalker. In between, the Oscar winner will publish a children's book, Sulwe, and she's this close to starting shoots on a television series based on Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie's Americana, which she is producing with her Black Panther co-star Danai Gurira writing the script. So, Nyong'o radiates the energy of a girl next door, especially as she recalls how she role-modeled early fashion choices, but she also happens to be one of the most powerful black women in film. Though her family is from Kenya's Luo tribe, Lupita Amandi Nyong'o was born in Mexico City in 1983. Her first name is derived from the name Guadalupe, the Virgin Mary. Her father, Peter Anyang Nyong'o, now a prominent Kenyan politician, and mother, Dorothy Ogata Nyong'o, had immigrated to Mexico shortly after Charles Nyong'o, her father's brother, was disappeared in 1980. Charles was never found. He was likely a target because of his opposition to the Moi presidency. The childhoods of Nyong'o and her five siblings would be marked by political pressures. They had to share their father with the rest of the community for the good of the fight, and lived in fear for his safety, particularly after the family returned to Kenya in 1984. Migration would become the norm for the family, and home was a fraught concept for Nyong'o, who would only spend the first few months of her life in Mexico City before the family moved to New York City. When she was 16, her parents sent her to Taxco, Mexico, to learn Spanish at the Universidad Nacional Autónoma de México's Learning Center for Foreigners. In 2003, she enrolled in Hampshire College in Amherst, Massachusetts, as an international student, immersing herself in African studies. We were really deeply investigating and exploring and analyzing a lot of socio-political dynamics, she says. My enlightenment was my education. to really recognize that these things play out in cultural and social setups. They don't play out theoretically. After graduating, she entered the Yale School of Drama. Nyong'o's introduction to Hollywood came in the form of her stint as a production assistant on The Constant Gardener. Then, in her last year at Yale, Lupita landed an audition with director Steve McQueen for a role in 12 Years a Slave, based on Solomon Northup's real-life account of his kidnapping and enslavement on Edwin Epps' Louisiana plantation. In the film, Nyong'o plays Patsy, a woman who was known to pick more than 500 pounds of cotton a day, twice the quota. Patsy was repeatedly raped by Epps and tortured by his jealous wife. The film's most devastating scene depicts Epps, Michael Fassbender, brutalizing Patsy after forcing Northup, Chiwetel Ejiofor, to whip her as well. It's reminiscent of Denzel Washington's turn as Private Silas Tripp in the 1989 film Glory. Like Washington, Nyong'o won an Oscar for her performance, thrusting her into the public eye and kicking and kick-starting a rapid ascent. In her acceptance speech, Nyong'o, in a baby blue Prada gown whose color she felt evoked Kenya, thanked Patsy, saying, "It doesn't escape me for one moment that so much joy in my life is thanks to so much pain in someone else's." "What struck me was her absolute readiness," says Nyong'o's 12 Years co-star Sarah Paulson, who played the abusive Mistress Epps. "Lupita was the personification of destiny. I also don't think I had ever seen a face filled with so much light. She is the definition of lit from within." Around the time the movie came out, she had been sleeping on a mattress on the floor of a New York apartment. "Too anxious about placelessness to spring for a bed frame," she told the Bad Brown Aunties, a podcast hosted by two fellow Hampshire alums. When she became the first Black African to win an Academy Award for acting, the accolade helped solidify her application for a green card. It was heart-wrenching to learn several years later of other battles that Nyong'o had been taking on during that moment in her career. In a bone-chilling op-ed in the New York Times, Nyong'o recounted her run-ins with Harvey Weinstein. She wrote in vivid detail of narrowly escaping the producer's grasp in the confines of his home with his family in nearby rooms. After another creepy encounter, she vowed never to work with him. She also vowed to never shut up about this kind of thing. Now, although she notes she is still limited to her own experiences and those that wind through the industry grapevine, Nyong'o says that in the nearly 2 years since, there is definitely more of a sensitivity towards sexism, chauvinism, abuse, and that many film sets often employ an intimacy coach. In the past, when it came to physical combat, there were always consultants on set. But when it came to intimacy, there was never, ever somebody present to help actors navigate that. Now you have that, which I think is a great inclusion and ensures that those kinds of abuses don't happen. She adds, "I think there's also at times an oversensitivity, which I just think is the nature of the pendulum shifting, and it takes time to find the balance. I'm quite happy that there is that kind of extreme change, and hopefully we find equilibrium as we move forward." Nyong'o has a reputation for keeping her private life private. Though fans have desperately tried to dreamcast romantic relationships with Michael B. Jordan and Jared Leto. Crowd Hope has more recently refocused on Janelle Monáe, though neither woman has publicly commented. When I ask how she handles curiosity about her love life, Nyong'o replies, "I feel like there's parts of myself that I care to share, and then there are parts that I don't. In my mind's eye, there's a highlight reel of images and videos of her cuddled with friends and co-stars. But I wonder When it is part of the celebrity's job description to have every relationship inventoried as friend or lover. And so, I dig a bit deeper about maintaining control over her image. I'm conscious of the danger of the intention to perpetuate a struggle without triumph, she says. What happens when we lose agency over our narratives? What does it mean to be one of Hollywood's most powerful women, yet still be susceptible to headlines that compress your life into something digestible? There's a thin line between your story being told and you being devoured. In 2017, Nyong'o made headlines because her hair was photoshopped for the UK cover of the Italian magazine Grazia. Nyong'o called the magazine out in an Instagram post, including photos of her unretouched image and a caption that stated, "Had I been consulted, I would have explained that I cannot support or condone the omission of what is my native heritage with the intention that they appreciate that there is still a very long way to go to combat the unconscious prejudice against black women's complexion, hairstyle, and texture." Nyong'o says she has learned to pick her battles. She says early in her life, she fought pettier ones. But purpose clarifies itself, and her courage to speak out is innate. I was born into a political family. My father was fighting for what he believed in, says Nyong'o. I think it was really just instilled in me that there are things in this world that are worth changing. Part of living is about trying to transform the world into, you know, the world that we want to be a part of. For every project she takes on, Nyong'o relies on gut instinct to guide her. As I prepare, I have to articulate to myself why I'm doing this. The secondary thing is definitely the people, she says. When I choose projects, I want to have faith that as an artist, it will speak to a time when it is needed as much as it speaks to me at the time that I make it. I really understood this with Black Panther. When we were making that movie in such a different political climate than the one in which it came out, says Nyong'o. Ryan Coogler and Joe Robert Cole wrote the film while Obama was still president, but it came out 1 year into Trump. Ryan was speaking to a future relevance that he could not have predicted. Nyong'o signed on to the project on the strength of Coogler's pitch alone, before a script existed. Marvel won't give you the script. Marvel won't give you the scripts, she emphasizes. I read the script for the first time 6 weeks before we started shooting. Black Panther, which grossed $1.347 billion in box offices across the globe, exploded conventional Hollywood's, which is to say, white, notions of what an all-black film could do commercially. More than that, in Black Panther, I felt that the African experience was allowed to exist aspirationally, says Nyong'o. I think it's more common in America to hear of the struggle of black people than it is to hear of the success. It's more of a sensation to have a headline about a struggle, you know, Lupita shunned by people for her hair texture. The struggle through having dark skin is clickbait. So when Black Panther came along, it was so refreshing to work on an African narrative that did not lead with the struggle of being African. Nyong'o has said her gut led her to take the role of Miss Caroline in this year's Little Monsters, a quirky indie horror comedy. The magnet, Taylor Swift's Shake It Off, was in the script. So Nyong'o taught herself to play it on the ukulele as director Abe Forsyth imagined for the role. She also immersed herself in the minutiae of being a kindergarten teacher, right down to creating lesson plans. I love deep diving into a character I'm playing, says Nyong'o, emphasizing that children posed a particular challenge. I would be so tired at the end of the day working with these kids. They're unpredictable. They've got a lot of energy. It was a doozy, but I loved it. I loved every moment of it. Like Forsyth, director Jordan Peele wrote the mirroring characters of Adelaide and Red specifically for Nyong'o in his thriller Us. Part of her immersive prep work for that film was watching a list of horror films recommended by Peele. They helped me and Jordan establish a shared cinematic language while shooting, says Nyong'o. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.